today, 2022 icebergs ahead. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. At the start of the new year, there are a number of significant risks on the horizon, and today I want to touch on some of those which may influence the financial markets and satiety more generally this year. Locally, of course, there is an election ahead, and the incumbent government has around $16 billion by way of a war chest, by the way of our money, earmarked in MyEFO to spend or bribe the community. As always, expect to see selected largesse targeting marginal seats, something which now seems just normal political behaviour, but which I think is disgusting. We saw that such largesse pushed house prices much higher than anyone expected, but the clouds are now gathering, with listings rising, lending tightening, and interest rate rises on the cards. Thus, our scenario suggests smaller gains and indeed potential falls in some areas ahead. First-time buyers are being priced out again, unless the government throws more incentives for those trying to get into the market. And watch for that, and also signals that they want to keep prices high. One reason why migration becomes important to stoke demand, especially for the languishing high-rise sector. More broadly in the financial markets, superficially, and especially in the US, they have performed well this year, hardly surprising given the massive government and central bank stimulus, especially since COVID hit. For the year, the S&P 500 posted a total return of 29%, while the Nasdaq closed up 22% and the Dow was up 21%, and even the Russell was up just shy of 15%. For the first time in two decades, the S&P 500 saw each of its 11 sectors finish with double-digit gains for the year. And reflect on this. The S&P 500 index has now doubled since New Year's 2018, capping a stretch of sustained strength with few precedents. 70 record highs in 2021 alone. It's amazing what all that government money and central bank money can do. The best December since 2010, pushing the index to 26 times earnings. In the past five sessions, the gauge added 0.9%, another up week in a year when positive closes made up 63% of the total. Though do remember that this is on low volumes at the end of December. Now, using monthly closes, you have to go back decades to find another period where the index's three-year total return exceeded 100%. Two decades, to be exact, to the busting of the internet bubble. And while nothing in that comparison is basis for panic in any rigorous statistical sense, it at least shows the dauntlessness of the current rally and the challenge investors face in deciding if it's sustainable. December's gains could be January's pain, said Mike Bailey, director of research at FBB Capital Partners. If investors are topping off their winners in December, that might dilute the January effect, he said. Pressure early on in 2022 may include more hawkish commentary from the Federal Reserve, inflation-constricted fourth-quarter earnings reports, and valuations that are near five-year peaks, and don't mention the virus. History shows that that might be the case. Following an annual return of greater than 20%, the S&P 500 tends to start out the year tepidly. That's the case for data going back to 1980, with Januaries that follow blockbuster years coming in flat on average. And that performance is worse than the average January return of 1.2% over the last eight decades, according to Jessica Raby, co-founder of DataTrek Research. There can be sizable downdraws in the first month of a new year after an outsized gain, she wrote in the note recently. Investors shouldn't expect this year's positive momentum to carry through next month. And while all the S&P 500 index sectors posted double-digit gains for the first time, with eight of them rising 20% and the best-performing group, energy, rose 48% after being the worst performer in 2020, by the way, the truth is amid the first COVID-19 wave, seven stocks in the S&P 500 tripled in 2020, compared with zero this year, while 15 fell by more than 40%, a fate that all avoided this time around. A lot of people think we might give some of this back as we enter the new year. That could happen. Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at Leithold Group, said he expects 2022 to be volatile overall and says returns won't be as robust as they were this year. On Friday last week, the S&P 500 finished at 4,766. That's down 0.26%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 0.16% and the Nasdaq traded down 0.6%. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index was down 0.15%. Now, we do see divergences in return from many stocks, especially growth names, as well as exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, that invest in them. The main indices ETFs saw double-digit gains in 2021. For example, the Dow Jones Industrial Average ETF Trust, which tracks the Dow Jones, was up 19.3% year-to-year. The S&P 500 SPY, which tracks the S&P 500 index, was up 27.7%. And the Invesco QQQ Trust, which tracks the NASDAQ, was up 28.1%. High growth tech shares typically get significant attention. Therefore, it's worth looking at ETFs that provided profitable access to those subsectors in the technology domain. iShares Semiconductor ETF was up 45.1%. The Van Eyck Semiconductor ETF was up 43.5%. And the SPDR Semiconductor ETF was up 43.2%. And from chip funds, we could move to general technology funds as well, as those with more distinctive themes like artificial intelligence, blockchain, electric vehicles and battery technologies, 5G, robotics, machine learning, or working from home. In those areas, there are, again, a number of funds that did very well. For example, the iShares US Technology ETF was up 36.6%, the Global X Lithium and Battery Tech ETF was up 36.5%, and the Vanguard Information Technology Index Fund was up 30.9%. Now, understandably, 2021 was not all about technology. There were several other ETFs that saw robust annual returns. For example, the BreakWave Dry Bulk Shipping ETF was up, wait for it, 266.9%. And the CraneShares Global Carbon ETF was up 104.6%. And the First Trust NASDAQ Oil and Gas ETF was up 69.3%. And the Van Eyck Rare Earth Strategic Metals was up 68.1%. But there were also a lot of losers. Not all ETFs had a good year. Many had a tough year. Contrarian investors who expect a rotation into some of these segments in 2022 might want to research those ETFs instead. They include CraneShares CSI China Internet ETF, down 54.4%, the Invesco Golden Dragon China ETF, down 47.4%, and the ProShares Long Online Short Stores ETF, down 40.8%, and the ARK Genomic Revolution ETF, down 35.6%. Now, the message here is simple. Not everything performs the same. Chief among investors' concerns in the new year is the Fed, which recently announced that it would speed up its withdrawal of economic stimulus. Steve Sosnick, chief strategist at Interactive Brokers, looked at the central bank's holdings of securities, which have gone up by roughly $130 billion this month through to Christmas. Now, that's not exactly a taper, he says. So when their purchase pace does start to slow more significantly, markets could react negatively. As the taper kicks in, we are more likely to get some corrections since the inflow of money into the system will be reduced, he said. That's why I'm expecting increased volatility. There seems to be a broad consensus that 2022 is going to be more challenging than 2021. For starters, the Federal Reserve is beginning the process of reversing its ultra-loose monetary policy. It's not moving fast enough relative to the inflation that it's unleashed, but it's doing so in an environment where markets are increasingly sensitive to the potential for higher interest rates due to the vast amount of leverage in the system and the amount of government debt incurred in the past few years. The yield curve is the undisputed heavyweight champion of market indicators, as inversion always predates a recession. And that's just a matter of timing. The Fed hasn't increased rates yet, and probably won't until March, but the yield curve has already flattened to a very slim 80 basis points, suggesting that we are moving ever closer to a recession. Now, the convention here is to use the difference between the yields in the 2 and 10-year US Treasury notes, but some would suggest that we should really be looking at the 3 or 6-month Treasury bill rate instead of the 2-year yields. Typically, it takes longer for the curve to invert when bills are used as the benchmark, which gives people hope that a recession is further away in the future than they think. The second is the speculation that this time is different and that maybe this particular flattening of the yield curve or even an inversion won't result in a recession. But the yield curve is the undisputed heavyweight champion of market indicators, and an inversion always predates a recession. It's just a matter of timing. If the Fed stays on its current path or accelerates, then it looks probable that the yield curve will invert sometime during early 2022, right around the time that the actual rate increases are forecast to start. Then the clock starts, as a recession can happen any time over the following 18 months, going by the relationship between inversions in the yield curve and economic contraction. The question then becomes, how much will the stock market drop? Potentially a lot. Stocks weren't particularly cheap before the pandemic, and there has been a lot of speculation and froth over the last 18 months or so. For example, a 20% drop, the technical definition of a bear market, would only take the S&P 500 index back to the beginning of 2021. There are others calling a 40, 50 or 60% drop. So we'll see. And investors also need to take the reaction function of the Fed into account. If the current high rates of inflation fail to recede, the Fed might panic and raise rates too far, too fast, triggering some type of crisis. There is so much room now for a policy misstep, and the stakes are getting higher and higher. In fact, the Fed already erred in believing that faster inflation was transitory, and the risk is that policymakers will make an error of the second type, overreacting and plunging the markets into chaos. That's not a zero-sum game, in my view, and it's not a zero chance. If that wasn't enough, 2022 will bring the midterm US elections. Current polls would suggest that the Democrats are heading for a big defeat in Congress, with Republicans gaining control of the House. A lot can change between now and November, but it's hard to see Democrats increasing their majority at that point. This has profound implications for fiscal policy. Huge Republican gains in the 1994 and 2010 midterm elections resulted in 6 years of relative austerity under Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The result was a budget surplus at the end of Clinton's second term. Fiscal spending was especially lean from 2010 to 2016 as the budget deficit shrank from around 10% of GDP to 2% of GDP. Republicans are by no means fiscally conservative, but they are reliably so when they're in opposition. A Republican majority in Congress would probably result in the budget deficit dwindling from $3 trillion US dollars to perhaps less than $1 trillion US. And since much of the current deficit consists of government transfer payments, the results will be far less consumer spending and a few percentage points less in GDP growth. And since inflation has been driven mostly by loose fiscal policy, austerity has the potential to slow or stop inflation. And next year will be tougher for the financial markets and the economy, but nobody should complain if stocks have very low or even no returns, because there is the potential for something much worse than that. Now, over in Australia, performance was less strong. Last Friday, the ASX 200 edged 0.9% lower, shaving 68 points from the benchmark, which closed the year at 7,444.6 points in Friday's shortened session. That drag led the market to a calendar year gain of 13%, marking the best year since the 23% jump in 2019 and the fourth best of the past decade, reflecting a pandemic rally that pushed the blue chip benchmark to a record high in August. The Friday decline in Australian shares brings the market to a weekly gain of 0.3% and drags the market 2.5% from the record high in August. And that was weighed down by whipsawing worries about the Omicron strain, which has spread rapidly across the country. That said, all 11 share market sectors traded down on Friday, with three closing more than 1% lower, led by property companies. The real estate sector shed 1.5%, consumer discretionary stocks lost 1.4%, and financials, the largest market sector, accounted for about a third of blue chips by market value, dropped 1.2%. The materials sector, the second largest, that represents a fifth of the ASX 200, was the day's best performer, falling just 0.5% on the day. Magellan Financial, which has faced a run of volatile trading over the past month, jumped more than 3% in the opening minutes of trade before easing lower through the day to close down 2.2%. The decline follows the sudden resignation of Chief Executive Brett Cairns and the loss of a large mandate from long-time investor St James Place earlier in the month. Paladin Energy led among blue chips on Friday, ending the session with a 6% gain, capping a stellar year in which the stock has tripled. Stocks are fully priced at the moment, and to my mind, there is a significant risk to the downside, but offset by the expectation of more central bank support to keep the bubble going some more. But bubble it is, and some are calling a deep correction during this year. We'll see. Now, gold ended the year the same way it spent much of the year, little changed and tottering along somewhere in the vicinity of $1,800 an ounce. After a tumultuous start to the pandemic that drove gold to record levels in 2020, the metal, famously touted as a hedge against rising prices, has failed to capitalize on this year's scorching hot inflation. Investors appear to have lost interest, leaving gold trading in tight ranges for weeks on end, while exchange-traded fund holdings trickle down. Spot gold has fallen around 4% this year, on track for its biggest annual decline since 2015. A stronger US dollar and the threat of a pullback in stimulus by the world's major central banks have deterred many investors who saw better opportunities in surging equity markets. The exciting booms and busts of Bitcoin, often touted as the digital equivalent to bullion, also captured attention. Gold started the year under pressure, dropping 10% in the first quarter. Vaccine successes spurred hopes for a quick recovery after the pandemic, while President Joe Biden's Democrats securing the US Senate opened the door to pro-growth infrastructure programs and more fiscal aid. Prices later rebounded after the emergence of new virus variants and political gridlock in the US, but then bullion got stuck in the doldrums. One key factor has been the lack of interest from financial investors, who are crucial to driving gold's rallies. Holdings in exchange-traded funds have dropped almost 9% through the year, while hedge funds trading COMEX futures have kept their bullion bets muted. Investors have largely cut back their gold positions this year. While the prospect of monetary tightening hurts gold's appeal, prices were supported by strong demand from Asian jewellery consumers and central bank buying. The opposing drivers have left bullion hovering almost magnetically around the $1,800 mark, and while that's historically high priced, it will be disappointing to those who enjoyed the surge to a record in 2020. However, the equilibrium between dip buyers and sellers may not hold for much longer. More gains in the dollar could spell misery. On the other hand, signs of persistent runaway inflation could provide the spark needed for a sustainable rally later. BlackRock's E.V. Hambro said earlier this month that gold could climb in 2022, driven by a combination of real interest rates, US dollar performance, and demand for haven assets. But analysts at J.P. Morgan see gold coming under more pressure as the global economic recovery continues, and forecasted an average price of $1,671 an ounce for next year. Now, turning to cryptos, Bitcoin and Ethereum look set to end a huge year on an off note, with two leading cryptocurrencies there down 2.8% and 2.2%. Now, Thomas Peffery took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal back in 2017, warning of the dangers that Bitcoin futures posed to capital markets. But these days, the Hungarian-born billionaire is well-versed in crypto speak. He's worth about $25 billion and says it's prudent to have 2 to 3% of one's personal wealth in cryptocurrencies just in case, quote, fiat currency goes to hell. He owns some himself, while his firm Interactive Brokers Group recently offered customers the ability to trade Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash after detecting urgency from its clients to get in on the action. The Greenwich, Connecticut-based Interactive Brokers will offer the ability to trade another 5 to 10 coins or so starting this month, and it's possible that cryptocurrencies could reap extraordinary returns, even if the opposite is also true, he said. I think it can go to zero, and I think it can go to $1 million, he said. I have no idea which. His approach highlights the shifting attitude towards crypto by investors who once scorned or were wary of digital tokens, but realized, especially in 2021, that they can't miss out of the potential for big gains. Even as prices swung wildly, investors large and small dived into Bitcoin and Ethereum, as well as non-fungible tokens, dog-themed assets, and shitcoins, including the aptly named dollar-ass coin. Ray Dalio recently revealed he was holding at least some Bitcoin and Ethereum in his portfolio only months after questioning crypto's utility as a store of wealth. And the Bridgewater Associates founder views the investments as an alternative money in a world where cash is trash and inflation erodes buying power. Paul Tudor Jones disclosed he's invested as a hedge against inflation, and almost half the family offices Goldman Sachs Group does business with were interested in adding digital currencies to their portfolios, according to a recent bank survey. Crypto moved increasingly into the mainstream of finance, albeit with mixed success. ProShares launched the first US Bitcoin futures ETF, which attracted more than $1 billion in 2 days before inflows spluttered and the price slumped since its October debut. Crypto enthusiasts are still hoping US regulators will approve an ETF that actually holds Bitcoin, but we'll see. Faring better, Coinbase went public and now has a $54 billion market valuation. Its founder, Brian Armstrong, is worth about $9.7 billion, according to recent analysis. And it was also a period when crypto collided with culture. An NFT from Beeple sold for $67.3 million at Christie's. Tom Brady released NFTs tied to his legendary career, while Katy Perry, Grimes, and the agency behind K-pop sensation BTS all sought to profit from the burgeoning industry. El Salvador's president even made Bitcoin legal in his country. The crypto marketing juggernaut will keep going in 2022. Staples Center in Los Angeles is now Crypto.com Arena, while FTX and Singapore's Crypto.com are running ads during the Super Bowl, even if prices don't necessarily climb to the moon. Michael Novogratz, who runs Galaxy Digital, said last month that prices could go sideways to down in the near term. There was a lot of froth in the market in 2021 as retail investors piled into NFTs and pursued unusual crypto investments. The New York-based digital evangelist also predicted Bitcoin won't fall below a floor of around $42,000. It closed the year at around $46,300. So much money is pouring into this space that it would make no sense if crypto prices were to go much below that, he said. Jesse Powell, chief executive officer of crypto exchange Kraken, acknowledges prices could fall, but said that any move below 40,000 US is a buying opportunity. He'd be quick to admit he's not always got it right. In August, he predicted prices would reach $100,000 a coin in 2021, and ARK Investment Management's Cathie Wood, meanwhile, still expects Bitcoin to reach $500,000 and said last month that it wasn't necessary due for a correction. Citadel's Ken Griffin recently described the rush to embrace cryptocurrencies as a jihadist call against the US dollar, but Griffin said his own firm would trade crypto if there were more regulation. JP Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon called Bitcoin worthless in October, but that came as the New York-based banking giant was bulking up hiring to help its clients trade digital currencies. The bank's clients are adults, Dimon said. As Joachim Book wrote, the concept of bubbles runs freely across the chronicles of financial history, and those who study it, the hand-waving arrogance with which many well-established financial historians would denounce something as a bubble, delusion, or financial madness will be familiar to most Bitcoiners reading the New York Times or The Economist today. Mostly, those otherwise astute academics meant to launch derogatory remarks on the sorts of people who handled assets and implied that real-world plebs in trading pits or exchanges couldn't possibly possess knowledge of superior kind, which would make their own university libraries embody them. Worse, when pushed, the idea of bubbles never seemed to mean much else than what goes up must come down. So What question does Bitcoin pose for monetary economics, monetary rules, macroeconomic stability, regression theorem, Gresham's law, and the classification of fiat commodity money? Is Bitcoin the monetary escape hatch necessary in a less free world? At the base of economics lies an information and calculation argument. Real market prices emerging in trade between willing participants generate information about the world. It allows us to calculate the profit and loss, to see if what we make is worth more than what we put in. It allows market participants, like all of us really, to grasp what's going on or not. Not, mind you, in the news agency way of broadcasting highly curated pictures from afar, but by informing your economic decisions. Shortages and price declines tell us what's scarcer and more plentiful, what's in high demand, and what's better used elsewhere. Financial markets and assets do the same thing for society's current and future allocation of savings. The prices of securities vary more than market prices because the far-off future and how to assess it is less knowable than the immediate, present, or recent past. The trouble with bubbles is that nobody knows the future. Asset prices incorporate the knowledge that exists about the present and forecast the future in the best way that we know how. If owners of securities are wrong about that future, they lose money or miss out on profitable investments. Scott Sumner of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University explains this well for the two most recent bubbles in US financial history, the dot-com bubble in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the housing bubble a few years later. He said, I think asset prices are usually relatively efficient based on fundamentals. I'm very dubious of people who claim that such and such a market is obviously overvalued. Most experts, I think, believe that the tech stocks in 2000 were obviously overvalued, or housing prices in 2006 were obviously overvalued. People were saying things like, those stock prices only make sense if you think American internet firms will eventually dominate the global economy. Well, they do now. All that 2006 housing prices only make sense if you think interest rates will get lower and lower and NIMBY, not in my backyard, regulations will stop new construction. Well, both of those happened as well. And we're now at a new normal of much higher housing prices in America. So he says, I think in these markets we're picking up some long-term trends that really did change the traditional fundamental price-earnings ratio or rent-price ratio in housing. Knowing that something is obviously overvalued is the kind of extreme hubris that opponents of Bitcoin suffer from in outsized amounts. The fundamental value is zero, says economist Steve Hanke. As renowned and astute a writer as Nassim Taleb wrote some mathematical equations and proved that Bitcoin's fundamental value was nil. How could they possibly know that? Well, perhaps they ran a model, mentally or computationally, plugged into some values and then popped out the other end a value. Could be, but we're testing the market irrationally. You're also implicitly testing the model. Irrational bubbles in stock prices, concluded the father of the efficient market hypothesis, Eugene Farmer, in the 1990s, are indistinguishable from rational time-varying expected returns. Fundamentals and our confidence in them change, which is reflected in asset prices moving up or down. Against Taleb, Nick Carter had the pithiest rebuttal. No, sir, it's 34,500, whatever the market priced it at when he said it. When prices fall after a rally, say internet stocks from 2000 to 2001, home prices from 2007 to 2009, or Bitcoin in April 2021, laymen and professionals alike say that it's a bubble. But what if the price increases captured something real and were then validated by future events? US median house prices recoup their losses 4 years later and today stand about 6% higher. That's nominally deflated by CPI. House prices were up about 60% higher than in 2021 than the peak in 2007. Internet stocks, including some of those ridiculed as hopelessly overvalued in 2001, dominate the US stock market, and their products and services have conquered the world. The chattering classes case against Netflix just a few years ago was similarly overwhelming. This hopeful tech company couldn't possibly monetize its overextended services. It would have to conquer the world for the stock's then valuation to make sense, and then it did exactly that. Netflix expanded services, upped its margins, and offered original content. Few are the analysts today yapping about Netflix as an obvious bubble. For the next year, some argue that bubble charges against Bitcoin, of which we saw a plenty this year, will fade away, both because angry non-coiners tire of making them when they're received with ridicule, and because the longer something stays alive, expands and flourishes, the less sense the etiquette makes. Nobody calls Amazon a bubble anymore, nor Netflix. Even Tesla's haters have largely surrendered, accepting that what propelled it into the fifth largest US company market by capitalization is something other than bubbling madness. No Bitcoiner takes the bubble attack seriously. Price matters, and only bubbles that fail, i.e. don't recover, are relegated to history's dustbin as bubbles. The successful ones are just promising ventures deemed as such by a future that has hindsight as a guide. Every society that collapsed into turmoil, economic, monetary, military, social, or other, has had individuals contemplating when to leave. It's not an easy decision, forecasting doom and deterioration for one's country of birth. Many are the migrants who can tell painful stories of uprooting their lives, made increasingly impossible by authorities, fame, war, or hyperinflation, for an uncertain existence elsewhere. When staring down the unending path to unfreedom that we're experimenting with these days, what else is there but to escape? When rule by the people is replaced by ruling the people, escape hatches are crucial. COVID-19 measures all over the world, and the agitated tendency with which troves of people embroil themselves shows that lines of privacy and tyranny drawn in the sand could be approached, flirted with, and then crossed by about a mile. Seeing the writing on the wall, like many others, we want a way out. And in an uncertain future, you never know which place becomes a beacon of freedom. 2 years ago, who would have bet on Sweden? And where that is, and now that it's conforming, where to? And who will confiscate your assets? The idea of a monetary escape hatch clicked, possibly with many people. When in doubt, wrote Ray Dalio in his new book, Get Out, if you don't want to be in a civil war or a war, you should get out while the getting is good. History has shown that when things get bad, the doors typically close for people who want to leave. The same is true for investments and money as countries introduce capital controls and other measures. If history is any guide, you won't be able to peacefully and in organized fashion be able to take your assets with you. When the flight of wealth gets bad enough, concluded Dalio, the country outlaws it. Plenty of Americans have taken that advice, though so far only in a regional sense. The exodus from California speaks volumes. Others living under oppression regimes in the West and elsewhere have taken similar actions, departing their domiciles for freer pastures elsewhere. Now, Bitcoin facilitates the monetary component of that shift to move value from an unfree jurisdiction to a freer one. When fleeing a sinking ship, you need your body, your health, and your loved ones. Ideally, you want your most treasured belongings too, which thanks to Bitcoin you can now carry without anybody knowing. It comes with the more important shift of holding funds outside the purview and control of your invasive government. Dan Held's Thanksgiving Wishes stated it clearest. With governments restricting more of our rights, what would be our light at the end of the tunnel? And with COVID, this trend has accelerated, with our movement and access to goods and resources diminished, all for the sake of public safety. You never know what you rely on until it's abruptly taken away. When your assets are confiscated, your money devalued, your transactions declined, and your bank decides to freeze your account for whatever made-up reason is trumpeting next, it's too late. Backups and escape hatches need to be in place before they're needed. I never saw the need for a monetary or financial escape before I had access to inflation protection and developed financial markets. I could move my funds wherever I wanted, whenever, for a slither of what it would have cost just a decade ago, except for the occasional technical glitch or misadventures in poor countries. My transactions were never declined. I had not, to put it bluntly, checked my financial privilege. Last decade or so, culminating with COVID-19, convinced me that the unproblematic and worryless existence that I'd taken for granted might not always be that way. Measures against this public emergency probably won't be what ultimately does in freedom, collapses societies and ushers in the authoritarianism of dystopias. But the COVID-19 cat is out of the bag now, and the power play that rulers experimented with this year and the last is from now on available at every political negotiation table like it never was before. With only vague references to public safety and astonishingly low barriers, locking up people in their homes is now a feasible option. The ability to escape, to get out, hasn't been this important in generations. And this time isn't different, but this time we have Bitcoin. Perhaps that will be enough. We will see. And finally to China. China Evergrande Group dialed back payment plans on billions of dollars of overdue wealth management products as its liquidity crisis showed little signs of easing. Evergrande will now pay each investor 8,000 yuan per month towards their principal between December and February 2022, according to a recent statement. Under the previous plan, investors could have expected a higher amount, depending on the principal they'd invested. The change reflects difficulties faced by Evergrande's wealth unit to keep honouring the terms, as it was unable to raise enough money from its investment projects, according to the statement. The firm will drop another proposal in late March and vowed to accelerate asset disposals through auctions and litigation to repay investors in the products. Missed payments on 40 billion yuan of wealth products sold by Evergrande to retail investors have sparked nationwide demonstrations, putting more pressure on Beijing to find a solution and avoid further unrest. More than 70,000 people bought the products, including many Evergrande employees, as the cash-strapped developer tapped them for funding. The developer will also halt payments on products held by current and former senior executives who have held the job after April 2018 and by their immediate families, the statement said. The distressed developer has offered three repayment options in September to soothe angry buyers of the high-yield products. For the cash option, investors could choose to get back 10% of their principal and interest every quarter, with full repayment in 2.5 years. Evergrande is struggling with more than $300 billion in liabilities as a government campaign to deleverage developers and curb years of housing speculation takes a toll. Already labelled a defaulter after missing coupon payments on two bonds, Evergrande is facing a maturity wall next year and said it plans to actively engage with offshore creditors on a debt restructuring plan. Traders looking for a turnaround in Asian stocks in 2022 will be keeping a watchful eye on Chinese stimulus, the direction of the dollar, fading retail participation, and the outlook for equity listings. The case for a rebound should be aided by a lower valuation after the MSCI Asia Pacific Index underperformed its global counterpart by around 20 percentage points last year. It declined some 4%, with China's regulatory crackdown and slower growth weighing on the index. But investors are hopeful that Beijing's return to pro-growth policies and higher vaccination rates in the region will reverse the trend this year. It's possible that Asian stocks outperform their global peers, as regional economies should start to see greater benefits from higher levels of vaccinations and reopenings, said David Chow, global market strategist for Asia-Pacific ex-Japan at Invesco. Traders expect mainland stocks to recover this year as Beijing pledges to bolster slowing economic growth, dragged by a property slump and weak consumption. Various ministries have vowed support, including greater cuts in fees and taxes, while the People's Bank of China is already pumping more liquidity into the financial system. Further easing measures are also expected. Political events such as the National People's Congress in March will be closely watched for more cues on pro-growth policies and the common prosperity drive. The 20th Party Congress is in the second half of 2022, and that's also important because it could cement President Xi Jinping's rule for life. The CSI 300 index remained in a technical correction for most of 2021, and after a year of regulation that battered tech, private tutoring, and property stocks, BlackRock and HSBC were among those saying the worst of China's regulatory crackdown may have passed. It seems important to have a focus on stability and growth in such an important year and not restructuring a new regulation, said Harold van der Leed, HSBC's head of equity strategy for Asia Pacific. China, which is the only country in the world now with a COVID-zero policy, will likely keep its borders shut ahead of the Winter Olympics in February, given the resurgence of domestic virus cases. But once international borders open, it could be a major catalyst for cyclical shares from airlines to luxury stocks across the region, with Chinese tourists the biggest spenders in the world. In terms of expectations, there's very little priced in for the reopening of China, said Zeki Shen, head of Asian equities at BNP Paribas Asset Management. On the other hand, more lockdowns could send shockwaves through Asian supply chains. Regional giants such as Samsung are already facing production issues. And with the Federal Reserve tapering stimulus and expecting to hike rates at least three times next year, a stronger dollar's impact on Asian assets is a concern. Together with weaker Chinese growth, it could weigh on commodities and currencies in 2022, adding to constraints on emerging Asian economies at a time of domestic monetary policy tightening. Southeast Asian shares look particularly vulnerable to capital outflows as Omicron spreads, although a repeat of the 2013 taper tantrum is unlikely. Still, a weaker yuan is good for Japan's export-heavy stock market. And JP Morgan Asset Management strategist Tai Hu says the Fed communicating adequately to prevent sharp swings in bond yields, interest rates and exchange rates, limiting the negative impact on Asian stocks. After a tumultuous year for Hong Kong stock listings, investors will be looking forward to a number of so-called homecoming IPOs, including Didi Global. Appetite for those listings could cool, however, on account of China's regulatory tightening. And meanwhile, the blank check company craze could finally make its way to Asia as the first wave of special purpose acquisition companies gain clearance to list in Singapore and Hong Kong rolls out a rule book. And it's worth just reflecting that what happens to China will definitely hit us here in Australia. So what are my calls for this year? Well, I think markets will struggle in 2022. I think house prices in Australia may slide. I think the Bitcoin momentum will continue, but the real story will be the disruption of the financial system. With the potential for rising rates, markets may shift. So caution, spreading risks, and understanding the difference between investment and speculation would be my watchword. And also, when you're listening to people talking about markets, ask yourself what they're selling. For those directly aligned to selling gold or silver or Bitcoin, have mixed motives at very best. But I think 2022 is going to be a volatile, bumpy ride. So buckle up and let's get going. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.